All right. Today we'll begin the second part of a three-part series on meditation and prayer. This particular series, or portion of lectures, will be entitled "Wounded: From Wounded to Self-Actualized God Images." From Wounded to Self-Actualized God Images. Basically, this works on the premise that show me your relationships and I will show you your image of God. Translated, what that means is the way that I view, cathect, and envision the God of my understanding is always filtered through my relationships. The more wounded my relationships, the more wounded my God image. The more healing my relationships are, the more healing and whole my image of God is. That's at least my premise. And what I thought we might do is we might go through and if you wish to add any in these categories, these three categories, from wounded child, adapted adult, and self-actualized adult, please feel free. Okay, if you resonate with any of these. Now, these wounded child images is basically the belief that God neglects, overcontrols, and punishes. In terms of the God function, if one has been wounded in their parental imaging, then one's image of God will be affected. In other words, our first gods, really, when we grow up, are our parents. This child, certainly, when disobedient, is punished, and probably severely. So, punished harshly for disobedience. And I would think that this child who learns to be punished harshly for disobedience, that the punishment is overdone. The punishment is greater than what is really called for. Second, the mistakes are not allowed. Okay? Mistakes are not allowed. This child who, growing up, had a sense that mistakes were not okay. They were not allowed. This child did not receive the affirmation and blessing that it's okay to make mistakes. The third feeling that a child growing up with his or her guardians or parents, that these feelings that this child will begin to internalize are an acute abandonment anxiety. What am I talking about? The fear, at least the fear, that mom or dad or the guardian or big sister or big brother may not be there, may not be here tomorrow if I did X. Fourth, I found someone who has wounded child issues in terms of God image. There's uncertainty, and this I find, this is very prevalent, uncertainty and confusion about the presence of God. This person in adulthood, this the way this is shifting, the way this is forming here as I'm speaking, is this carries over into adulthood. If you've ever felt, well, God, I'm not quite sure. I'm uncertain. I'm confused about the presence of my higher power or God. Where you may need to look is to go back when you were growing up. Were you ever confused and scared or uncertain about the presence of guides, about the presence of parents? Finally, and this is not for all cases, but for some adults who present themselves with a severely wounded child inside of them, feel as though they are a victim in the world and feel as though they need to offer themselves up as a sacrifice to the world to be loved or accepted by God. Basically, so victim, sacrifice, maybe an image. Certainly the image is selfless. Be selfless. Put yourself last, not first. So this child learned whenever they put themselves first or they would assert themselves or affirm themselves, the message might be given, you always think of yourself, you shouldn't be so selfish. So to affirm the self would be a selfish act. Adapted child. Adapted adult is the second phase. Now, wounded child, probably what? Age 1, 2, probably 14. This is formed. The wounded child forms these, as you can see, primarily negative or ambivalent or mixed feelings about how God functions. Now, at age 14, to question mark, could be age 14 to death, would be what I would call the adapted adult or socialized adult. And basically, the image of God here is more of a sporadic kind of image of God that really occurs during times when the adult feels out of control. 911 prayer. And we'll get to the issue of prayer in our next lecture. But 911 prayer would be the signal to the adapted, socialized adult. Also, certainly, the taking out of some spiritual insurance policy. I'm speaking in general. Okay, the adapted adult feels as though that there should be some spiritual insurance policy. That might mean a ritual of prayer. That might mean going to church or a temple once a week. That might mean if you have children to make sure that they're baptized or bar a bas mitzvah. But some kind of spiritual insurance policy. Giving to an organization of need or a charity or a hospital. Motivated not by unconditional love or regard, but for insurance. If I give this, then maybe when I die, if there is a God, and I think there might be, I won't be in the lowest level of torment and punishment in hell. The adapted adult really is motivated by fear and approval seeking. What I've also found with the adapted adult often is that they will be motivated in terms of their image of God if they've been if they have some issues of anger towards God. A lot of times they can use avoidance. In other words, they'll leave organized religion or institutionalized religion, but they'll leave it not because it's no longer necessary. They leave it because they're angry. They have issues, and so they'll deal with their anger or their unresolved issues with God by avoiding. Sort of a passive-aggressive response. And the last element of the adapted adult, age 14 to death, possibly, is if the church or organized religion is used, it's really used as a network for sort of minimal fellowship of survival, jobs. I'm going to go to church in order to make this connection with these people so that they will support my business. It becomes extremely conventional. Certainly, what I also see is using rules of a religion to counteract out of control behavior and guilt. This person, when they experience crisis due to out of control behavior or guilt around perhaps behavior that will be immoral. Sometimes we'll use the rules of religion and be very, very persistent if they engage in religion. Be very rigid, not allow themselves any kind of creativity within it. And they'll be quite compulsive in their religiosity. And six, using religion to avoid reality. In other words, religion sometimes will be used as a way of just getting out of one's problems. Some kind of schema of hope that they use once a week or whenever they need in order to have some framework of transcendence to get out of their trapped self. Is this speaking to anybody? I mean, in looking, in so many people with whom I deal, with whom I work, a lot of this is unconscious. It's unconscious, and it's brought forth to consciousness in the process of spiritual counseling. No, go ahead.
Isn't three out of place there, avoidance of the anger of God, but the other categories of using religion, socializing religion to a purpose of avoidance seems to be going the opposite direction.
Right. And well, what you'll find is, just like with the realm of addiction, addiction is either over-attached to something, but it also is avoidance, isn't it? There's always a two-pronged dynamic with addiction. Also acting in and acting out. Acting in behaviors having to do with depression. Shutting down in the self, right? Is an avoidance strategy. But there's also acting out behaviors where I'm connecting here, there, and everywhere else, and then I'm not really gaining an interiority. This would be the dynamic I'm talking about here. So it's really a dynamic of being, of not finding one's middle. I'm really glad you brought that up. Please, any questions? Do this really helps define what we're talking about, because this is really only in the working stages. Okay. So it's finding, it's really the inability to find one's middle, one's balance, is what both of these, the wounded child images and the adapted adult behavior, if you will, or concept, end concept, that both of these have to do with not finding the middle. So this would be on the other side, avoidance, passive-aggressive anger. This would be over-attachment and improper use of dogma in order to kind of feel okay about oneself. But it would be pretty guilt-motivated. So one would be guilt-motivated, the other would be what? Passive-aggressive oriented. Even the atheist would come under here. Okay? The atheist would come under here who is so anti the transcendent with emotion that they have unresolved issues that they're not confronting with the transcendent. So the dogmatic theist and the atheist would come under this category. Okay. Any questions at this point? Okay, what I'm calling, for lack of a better term that I can think of, and maybe you can help me with this category, I'm calling the self-actualizing adult. And I, not self with the small s, but self with the large s. I know Abraham Maslow and his hierarchy of needs and the self-actualized self, these basic tenets of Abraham Maslow's self-actualization theory. I'm using it in the same sense, basically, where the self has really begun to live holistically, that is, integrating heart, mind, body, spirit. Beginning to integrate wisdom in action. Integration is the key word here. Integration of wisdom, action. An unconditional love response to the inner self with a capital S. This self-actualizing adult has begun to have self and other regard. You know, basic regard for themselves and others. So this particular self, use Richard's model of bag, boundaries, affirmation, and grief. This self has really begun to have a sense of boundaries, to have a sense of self-affirmation, and have a sense of the grief process. Now, what is the grief process about? It's grieving all this. All these wounded images from all those who have taken care of us and have abused us. But as we know, as we find in psychology and psychotherapy, a self cannot grieve if it doesn't have boundaries. Correct? There's no way that I can grieve until I feel safe enough, until I have a self. And so what boundaries are about is finding the middle. For one person who's acting out, this person needs to hang back a little bit more, be more self-contained. And then he will be able to grieve. For this person, if they act in and they struggle with depression and just falling in on themselves and isolating themselves, they're going to probably need to more respond to the fellowship of 12-step program and other support fellowships for balance. This would be boundaries. Affirmation, maybe just breaking through denial. Affirmation may be healing statements, but it's also about the self. I can do this. It's okay to make mistakes, right? It's the counterscript, if you will, to the wounded child and the adapted adult. But it's also about facing reality. Affirmation, in affirmation, I accept reality in the now for what it is. And I work with it. So this dialectic of boundaries, affirmation, and grief, and then I mourn. I mourn when I have myself back. Nothing is more profound, isn't it, when we see someone and we experience ourselves really grieve. All of a sudden we get ourselves back. We're not wanting to be rescued. We're not acting. We're not trying to provoke responses. We're just grieving. We're grieving the wound. There really are two kinds of people, aren't there? Those who examine their wounds and those who live the unexamined life.
Can you explain the provoking of responses? Because I find myself doing that a lot in my life.
Okay. Well, it's that other side of things. You know, it seems I'm in the victim or I'm in the victimizer. Okay? Or I'm in the rescuer mode or I want to be rescued. So if I'm wanting to provoke responses by some kind of emotional acting out or some facial expression or, you know, I probably learned that when I was a kid, that the only way I could get attention is if I did stuff real big. Became histrionic or threw a tantrum or pouted and ran to my room or I had to provoke responses.
Being irritating to people and like
that. Sure, the negative attention. If I was irritating, then I'd get energy because energy is presence. That's a good question you're asking. So, you know, these patterns that are learned take many years to learn. And a lot of spirituality, a lot of God imaging is about repatterning. It takes years. It takes years to cultivate and repattern. What this is really about, we haven't talked about God images at all right here, have we? We've really only talked about the conditions for God images to emerge. So in the self actualizing adult is no longer taking out spirituality insurance. It's no longer motivated by guilt, fear, shame, or the need for approval. The self-actualizing adult is also not working out of wounded child images, wondering whether God's really present or there, or maybe God will abandon him or her if they do something wrong, or God is an over-controller, or will punish me if I do this or I do that. The self-actualizing adult recognizes that the images of God are probably always self-affirming and not self-negating. Like unconditional love might be an image of the self-actualizing adult. An image of God would be unconditional love, or ultimate good, or absolute truth, or oneness. In this model, what the self begins doing is really looking at the obstacles to spiritual growth. You know, we talked about those on Sunday last week. What are the obstacles to spiritual growth? And the obstacles to spiritual growth are those demons inside. Those are all of those ways that we overattach or avoid and stay spiritually ignorant about our true nature. Okay, one of the most basic spiritual obstacles to our growth is fear. Fear of what? Fear of losing ourself, our identity, in something else or someone else. Fear of ego annihilation. Fear of absorption. Fear of merging. Right? And we have another fear that's on the other end, fear of isolation. Fear of abandonment. Fear of not having the connection, of feeling whole. What are the negative messages? If you were to ask yourself, if you wanted to heal your wounded God images, first of all, you'd have to come up with what is a wounded image of God that you have inside. Does any of this discussion, that, or actually it's a lecture, we haven't discussed a lot, but do you have any images that emerge in you right now as you're hearing me that might be negative in terms of a negative image of God that has been operative in your past? I mean, it may not necessarily be today, but if you looked at your life, what might be a negative image of God that you've had in the way that God functions or a word to describe God? Okay, that's good. So your image had to do with God some unconscious expectation that there was a kind of a magical number of mistakes, and when you did those mistakes, then you were no longer going to be accepted to the kingdom, or you would be totally rejected by God. That's powerful. Can anybody resonate with that? There was a certain number of mistakes or a certain thing that you would do. I mean, where'd you get that certain number of mistakes? I can't think of any scriptural passage. When I think of the scriptural passages, in fact, I think of forgiving 7 times 7, which 7 being a very mystical number of forever and eternal. But I can suspect that expectation may have been given to you by a wounded mentor, a wounded teacher. If not a parent, a minister, a teacher, or someone who you connected to your God images as they were being developed.
I call them, you know, God gives you crosses to bear. Like I say, say you have a sick child. Sometimes they say, why me? You know, you blame it on God. Or if somebody dies in the family, you say, you know, why at a young age? And you say, you know, like, why did God pick on me? Is that blaming God? Is that blame? Like, why do you pick on me to do this, so you blame God for it.
What that says to me is, and I find this a whole lot, this has been a real frequent one that has emerged in groups that I've done around the God image, that somehow when bad things happen to me, I believe that it must have been my fault. So God's not with me. He might be with, or she may be with, for someone else. But when bad stuff happens to me, God's not with me, and it must be about something I've done wrong. So probably maybe I've done some things in the past, and like, God's just not with me anymore. Maybe I've gone past that number. I think yours relates to, maybe I've gone past that number, and God just isn't with me, and I'm destined and doomed. Does this make sense? This is very frequent. So the image of God that would emerge would probably be a kind of a judge, you know, perhaps, that would be pretty impersonal, and that somehow you just missed it. When they were passing out, you know, the favor of God, they passed you over. And, you know, and sometimes maybe, you know, when you've connected to organized religion or some kind of fellowship of moral development, you know, it's probably your self-esteem has been pretty low. You don't quite sure know whether you deserve all this or whether you buy it all, you know.
What I find really interesting is when you hear of the many stories of people who have really had no upbringing with God, but when they're faced in a crisis, being stranded in the middle of an ocean somewhere, an airplane going down, that they almost instinctively, like it's blueprinted in our brain, they revert to prayer, or they will scream the word God out.
Yeah.
People who are essentially non-religious or have been most of their lives seem to just instinctively react like that.
Yeah. There are a few atheists in cancer wards, or in AIDS wards. Yeah. You're absolutely correct. In an emergency that hits us from our deep gut, the first thing to emerge in our psyche, I think you're right, it's almost collectively in our psyche, is, oh God, God help me. God help me. That would be the 911 prayer. Now, it's not necessarily that this is false. Okay, 911 prayer or emergency prayer, and we'll talk about that in the next lecture, there's nothing wrong with it as long as it's in the background. As long as it's part of the repertoire. But what you're suggesting is, I think, it's a phenomenon. The passive-aggressive atheist, or the passive-aggressive person who's really pissed off at the whole issue of God, okay? Even that passive-aggressive atheist, if they all of a sudden were an airplane was crashing and plummeting down to the ground and they were in it, even, you know, one would probably hypothesize that this person, male or female, would say, oh God, oh my God. Okay. 911 prayer is not bad, but for the self-actualizing adult, 911 prayer is used as part of the grand repertoire. It's the background rather than the foreground. So the dialogue with the transcendent or the dialogue with the divine for the self-actualizing adult, whom all of you are, if you are embracing your recovery program, a self-discipline program daily, and you're getting in touch with your body and your mind and your heart as much as you can today, you know, you're a self-actualizing adult, what will probably happen is 911 response to God will be much in the background. You know, it's like that friend that you only call when you need them. You're not really in a relationship with that person that's all abiding. You don't really know who that person is, but they kind of help you in a jam. But it's the friendships that you want to share your joys, your questions, your bewilderment, your total soul with, who you know totally accepts you. Now that is a relationship. And so the movement from the wounded child image to here, you see how it progresses and it's developmental. The wounded child image, which would be what yours would come under, in terms of there's so many things, if I do this many things wrong, then God's like, this would be the uncertainty and confusion about the presence of God. Okay? And it develops. As you heal it, I'm sorry, as you heal this, it will then get, it'll move to more a sense of, gee, the more I'm certain that I have friends who I can tell my whole soul to and they accept me, it's magical, because then I begin to see God acting that way. This is the magic of what we're talking about. That the more you heal your human relationships, you will find, if you're not finding already, that your images of how God is also changing, is also more healed. The more confidence that you have in yourself and in others helping you in a healthy way, the more confidence you will also have with your God image. It's real powerful. What comes to mind is, wherever two or more are gathered, there I am in the midst of them. Wherever two are gathered in my name, in the name of wholeness, in God's name, there, you know, there I am, I being God. So what is that? That's the bond, the fellowship, the unconditional love and regard. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I read the Old Testament several times. I find it's kind of a theme, like when things are going good, you know, they kind of abandon God, and then He punishes them, and they ask for forgiveness. You know, for example, like things go good, so they start believing the false gods, adultery, fornication. So God gets mad, and all of a sudden the flood or the fire or the pestilence or the locust or something comes, and these people, then they ask forgiveness, they're sorry, so this God, restores them to plentiful stuff, and then they get off the track again with false, and I just see this kind of theme in the Old, just kind of recurring itself, where when things go good, they kind of fall away from God, so God punishes them, then things go bad, so they ask forgiveness, so He does forgive them, and it's kind of just kind of the same.
The same cycle.
Yeah, kind of.
Where would you put that? Where would you put that? In the wounded child, adapted adult, or self-actualized adult? Where would you put that? In which category? The biblical, the typical biblical scenario of when in abundance, I don't need God anymore, so I turn away from God. God then balances me by sending me some kind of plague or misfortune, and then out of humility, I cry out to God, then God restores me to the covenant. Where would this very good. Yeah. That's where I'd put it. I mean, this is great stuff. This is where I'd put it. It would be the adapted adult. And the bottom line is, guess what? God will act wherever you happen to be in the column. I mean, God, wherever you happen to be in your consciousness, the divine will act in your life. So this particular person who is in the consciousness where they can't handle their adulthood, okay, they can't handle it. When they're in abundance or where they have a lot of power and energy, they abuse it and go, I don't need God anymore. It's the lower nature. That's the fall, if you will, the fall of Genesis, right? So when they get to that point where they have power and control and they abuse it and stop centering, they stop the centering. They don't go back to the tree of life. Right? They eat of the tree of duality. Of abundance and scarcity. And when they're in abundance, they don't need God anymore. And when they're in scarcity, oh God, please help me. They've eaten from the tree of duality, the tree of good and evil. Okay, that was the tree of the fallen nature. And each of us have a seed in us from those who ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and also those who ate the ancient races of the sons of God, sons and daughters of God, who ate from the tree of life. And so, that's powerful that you mentioned that. It would seem to me that would come under the adapted adult who just isn't grown up yet to be empowered or know what to do with power. That when they do receive some power, they end up turning away from the centering process.
One other thing I see in recovery, kind of going back to the Garden of Eden, all these beautiful things are out there. You can have them all. This one tree with this apple, you can't have that. It's kind of like me with alcohol. I can have all these beautiful things. I mean, good dinners, Gatorade, all kinds of liquid, but alcohol. And what's the one damn thing I want? The alcohol. The only one thing, every other beautiful thing in this world I can have. Sunsets, dinners, candlelight. But it is kind of always, my mind kind of always just back to the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve could have everything. The only one, that forbidden fruit, that apple tree. Said you can't have that, but anything else you can have. And the one thing you can't have is the thing you want. It's kind of like with a kid using reverse psychology on him, saying, if you do that, I'll be so ill. He'll to get him to do something, you tell him not to do it, he'll do it. And it's, I see that with kids a lot, that if you tell him to do something, he won't do it, but you say, no, I don't want you to do that, and so he'll go do it, that's how you get him to do it. It's kind of, this what you can't have is the thing you want, and everything else you can have is good.
That would certainly be one way of looking at it. That thing that I can't have, I want because someone said I couldn't have it. That would be one way of looking at it. Probably that way of looking at it would probably be somewhere in the wounded child. Okay? That way of looking at life, that mom and dad say no, that must be good, and I want that because... And saying no is the way I move from childhood to adolescence. Right? Negative freedom. Negative freedom is when I begin saying no and I'm a me and I'm a self. So you say I don't want that, I must want that because you say I can't have it. So it's kind of somewhere between the wounded child and adolescent who's moving to the adapted adult. But there's another way of looking at this, and this is, if I have this object that I want and that I desire, if I really take a look at what it's providing me, what is it really? Is it an obstacle more than it is an object of satisfaction? Exactly. Well, certainly with your addiction, right? What occurs is your very addiction or the object of your addiction becomes a god. But not only that, so it gets in the way. It should be an icon, if anything. But the ancient cultures, don't forget, ancient cultures, Neil, used drugs as windows to convey to the infinite, to convey the self to the infinite. Under extreme scientific scrutiny of masters, first of all, and secondly, very infrequently. There was never such thing for the ancients as a recreational drug. Never such a thing. Never such a thing. Drugs were powerful medicine. Powerful medicine. Only to be used for a variety of healing, right? Herbs, healing purposes, medicinal purposes, but also for spiritual services in very extreme and highly initiating circumstances. The problem with our culture today is that you have adolescents who are adults who recreationally use these power tools before they have goal, before they really are connected to the transcendent, before they're really spiritually ripe. So what happens then is they go off the track and are spun out by the drug itself, and the drug becomes a god. Or those who are non-addicted just don't get anywhere by using the drug. You know, those who use recreationally is used to avoid reality. So the drug really becomes an obstacle even for the person who's not addicted. Because not become a window to the transcendent, but becomes an obstacle. In Christianity, what's the drug that's used in ceremonies? Exactly, wine. In Judaism, wine again. Okay, Native American ceremonies, you know, it's for some of them, peyote. In some Brazilian cultures, certainly the herbs that are hallucinogenic, hashish. Or some oriental opium for oriental cultures. But what happens when the drug is used recreationally and doesn't have the respect and reverence and scrutiny of a practiced guide and school, it will cause the reverse. It will cause the destruction. And I will convey to you what I believe to be a law, a metaphysical law, is that once the power tool, whatever the power tool is, once the power tool, especially if it's a drug, once you become addicted to this power tool, it can never be used. The door must close because it will become itself a higher power and close the door that will convey you, Neil, to your ultimate bliss. So another way of looking at this is, it's not you can't have this, so you can't be happy like all these other people can. But you've already misused this, not only because of your own choice, it may be even genetic, going back generations to generations of others in your family, in your genetic pool, who misuse this power tool. So what the genes are saying to you soulfully is, do not use this. You cannot use this because it becomes itself God. It will close the door to the transcendent in your wholeness as opposed to opening it. Does that make sense? So that's why it's a taboo, not so that you will experience pain, but so that you will go in your journey and unfold and develop. Same thing for incest. If incest was not a taboo in spiritual culture, what would happen? If incest was the norm, as opposed to individuals going out and moving and broadening and creating and moving out of the family, if incest was the norm, what would happen? There'd be no evolution. There'd be no development. Everything would be unfolded in itself, and you wouldn't have, because it's organic and natural and spiritual to go into the different and to incorporate that different in a more total body spiritually. So, you know, the incest taboo is actually rooted in a spiritual law. But that would be another example.
Like priests don't get married now, there's a nepotism, they become bishops and pass it down to their children or something, where that's why there's a hierarchy, like the cardinals are bishops, you know, it's in the Catholic Church. Why people often ask, why don't priests get married? I think at one time they did, like that, they did, but yes, they developed this thing called, is it, was a nepotism or something, where people seem to, like you were saying about incest, get involved in their own family, they somebody become a bishop and point is to make a son ordained priest, and I don't know if this had anything to do with it, but it would keep it from broadening the religion more or less. But now with the hierarchy, it makes, you know, governments make the decisions is more of a broad. Like I said, I don't want to get off on, but I just.
Yeah, this may be going a bit too far afield or infield, but the question of hierarchy and the question of initiation, because the higher one goes in a hierarchy of development, of self-actualization, there are titles that are appropriate to where one is. You know, whether it's master, or whether it's doctor, or whether it's guru, or whether it's bishop, or whether it's father, or whether it's mother. You know, there are titles appropriate. And the whole issue of bishops, and the whole issue of, you're talking about another one too, the issue of celibacy. That is a charism about how to sublimate sexual energy for deeper inroads into the transcendent aspect of the spiritual journey. Really meant for the healthy. Only for the healthy. Celibacy is not meant for the unhealthy. For those people who are acting in, and so, well, great. I don't want to even deal with sex, so I'll take the celibate life, because that would be an intimacy issue. So these are spiritual issues. They're metaphysical issues. They deal with specific charisms. Celibacy was a monastic charism anyway, and I do believe it was connected to the charism in the early church, to bishops, not to priests. Priests were married, exactly. But I guess the bottom line, to go back to our center and then end our discussion today, is that as we heal our relationships, our images of God will be healed as well. Our relationship with ourself, our family, our authority figures and our mentors. Trust in this. 12-step recovery, that's why it's so important. The we, the fellowship, the sharing, is about learning how to establish boundaries, to affirm what is most good about the self, to affirm what is the case for reality, and grieving our wounds, examining transcendence, not by avoidance, but transcendence by the working and passing through.